Hey, George Norrie is returning to the historic Everett Theater in Everett, Washington, Saturday, March 23rd from 5 to 8 p.m. And along with George, a list of incredible guests, including the director of the National UFO Reporting Center, Peter Davenport, esoteric researcher Johnny Enoch, afterlife expert and near-death experiencer Danyon Brinkley, and an expert on mysticism, prophecy, and the occult, rogue scholar John Hoag. There'll be a live band, of course, audience participation, and a meet and greet to follow. It's an event you don't want to miss. Get your tickets now while they last. You can buy tickets by going to coasttocoastam.com and just look for George Norrie's events up in the menu. And you can also buy tickets by calling 425-258-6766. 425-258-6766. Your questions and comments for Shelley Neese, author of The Copper Scroll Project, when Coast to Coast continues right after this. Shelley, before we dive into the calls, we were talking about how Jim Barfield, you said, is convinced that the Ark of the Covenant lies beneath the ruins of Qumran. And I wanted you to finish up on that point before we start taking some calls.
Right. So there's actually a mound just northwest of Qumran, very close to it, but technically outside of the ruins. Jim Barfield, I had said that, you know, that he wasn't able to get permission to do an electronic survey of Qumran with the Lorenz metal detector, but he actually has done one at three of the 60 sites. It was a member of Knesset, Israel's Knesset, which is their parliamentary body, named Moshe Feiglin, who is just a very gutsy guy, has been arrested many times for visiting the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, and he's just a politician that seems to not care about playing too close to the rules. And so he, through a series of course of events, and meets Jim Barfield and hears about his research, and volunteers to use his Knesset immunity and do a scan with the Lorenz detector of several sites at Qumran with or without permission from the Antiquities Authority. And that's what he does. And so we actually have positive proof that there is something large, something non-ferrous, and deep underground, both in Qumran and at this site that Jim Barfield's research specifically points to right outside of Qumran.
And so he thinks that's the Ark, but doesn't the mercy seat on the Ark, isn't it covered in gold?
Yes, and it's acacia wood that's all gilded. So the nice part is that just like in Egypt and just like with the Dead Sea Scrolls, is that in the Judean desert, if acacia wood was buried deeply somewhere in the Judean desert, it would come out looking pretty much the same as it went in. And gold as well, you know, doesn't tarnish and survives the test of time pretty well. So both of those would be detectable and also look pretty good, pretty well preserved.
My word.
So we don't know exactly what would be there, but we just know that we got a positive scan for something that's related to the Copper Scroll, or something that's large, non-ferrous, and buried deep, which I can't imagine anything other than Copper Scroll treasure for that.
If it is the Ark of the Covenant there, I mean, that would be the greatest archaeological discovery of all time.
Yes, listen, I mean, people speculate about the Ark of the Covenant state, but one thing that I'll tell you about Jewish history is that there's a day on the calendar every year that Jews mourn the loss of the first temple and the second temple, and that they memorialize it. There is no such day for the Ark of the Covenant, and the Ark of the Covenant is what gave the temple its, you know, imparted its holiness, imparted its sanctity. It was in the holiest of holies. So really just the narrative about what happened to it is erased and it's gone, but it's not, the Jewish tradition does not say that the Ark of the Covenant's lost. You know, even with Temple Mount movements that have recreated lots of items for the Third Temple, they don't recreate the Ark. Like, the Ark is meant to be found. You can't make an Ark replica for any future temple. It has to be the original.
Right, and the Third Temple cannot be built without the Ark. Now, The Ark, according to legend, awesome destructive power. The only people that can approach the Ark would be the Levites.
Exactly. So Jem Barfield, being a religious man, has been very serious. He takes this very serious. And so part of his meetings with the Sanhedrin and with the religious and institutional bodies in Israel is to say, should this event take place, should we be able to unseal this potential cave outside of Qumran or any of these items be unearthed in Qumran, we need priests there. And Israel, there's a list. Kohanim are. They know who they are. Several in the Temple Mount movement study how to handle these objects and are prepared should that day come. And so he had one meeting with a leader of one of the Temple Mount movement people, and Gershom Solomon is his name, and he asked him, should this happen, Qumran is not so far from Jerusalem, should this happen, how quickly could you get priests here? And Gershom said, give me an hour. So it's got the Cohen on speed dial.
Wow. Let's say hi to Laura on the wildcard line. She's in upstate New York. Laura, good morning. Welcome to Coast AM.
Thank you, Richard, and thank you, Shelley, for such an interesting conversation this evening or this morning. I just have two things. The first is, I'm really sorry, George Norrie has had on a lot of people over time that discuss the Ark of the Covenant, and there's been so much information about it. So can I ask you please to explain what it is, what its significance is, and if it's found, what it would look like? And then the other thing I just wanted to mention, it sounds like you've found it already, but in case you need to do another similar type of scan, TED Talks, there was a woman that came on and did a TED Talk and actually won the TED Prize. Every year they give them a prize. I think it's like $1 million or something. And it was like either last year or the year before, where she was using satellites to unearth archaeological finds. And she found a whole city with this satellite, and they gave her the award. So you can, check the TED Awards for the last 2 or 3 years and see who this woman is in case you need more information about doing these scans with satellite. And then the last thing is, I've had a lot of interactions with dowsers, and I found that actually they're pretty accurate with regard to finding lost objects. So someone in this scenario might want to hire a dowser along with all the other things. But if you could just say a few words about the Ark of the Covenant, what it is and what it would look like, I'd greatly appreciate that. And thank you again for a very informative evening.
Thank you, Laura. Great call. All right. So for those not familiar with the Ark of the Covenant, tell us about it.
Sure. So the Ark of the Covenant is most exceptional because we're talking about Judaism. This is an iconic religion. It doesn't have material goods or objects of worship. It's totally forbidden. And so the Ark of the Covenant is really unique in that way, especially within its place in Judaism. But it's a material connection to an immaterial God. So the Ark is God's throne and its footstool, and God's footstool. According to tradition, the Ark also had its own, kind of inexplicable powers. It was made from acacia wood, gilded in gold, topped with two winged cherubs. The angel's gold wings stretched out over the Ark's pure gold cover, or the mercy seat. And a lot of people feel that even more important than the Ark itself and the construction of the Ark itself is that, because it was actually rather small, the Ark, according to the Bible, there's a little bit of discrepancy here, but it was about 4 feet long and 2.5 feet deep. So it's pretty small. But inside of it was placed the tablets of stone with the Ten Commandments. And so you can see that, two ways in terms of what's more important there, the Ark itself or what it contains. Now, like I said, the Copper Scroll doesn't ever specifically reference the Ark of the Covenant. According to some translations, it does reference Gleaming Chamber. And one part of the Copper Scroll, it may be the earliest reference to Shekhinah, which is the Spirit of God. it's really, we don't have any other older references to that specific word. And usually when Shekhinah is referenced, it's talking about the Spirit of God and in reference to the Ark of the Covenant. I love what the caller pointed out, and I am familiar with the winner of that, of the TED Award. And amazing things are happening in archaeology right now. And one thing that an Israeli archaeologist told me, you know, we had suffered for years in terms of applying for this permit to do the scan and really not understanding why Jim Barfield wasn't able to get it. I mean, he wasn't applying for himself to do the scan. He was working with established archaeologists who were also baffled. But one of them told me, look, we're sitting here applying for this permit when and going through the old process and the procedure that exists now to do these things. But truth be told, scans can be done from the sky now. You know, how are any antiquities authorities going to be able to control the future in terms of that scans can be done from satellites and from other pieces of technology? So that really will just be the next chapter in archaeology. We're still playing by the old rules and trying to apply for these things and going through that process. But really, we can do scans through satellites now. And so that's the future of this.
What about dowsers? Let's go back to some old technology. Dowsing.
Sure. So Jim Barfield hasn't participated in that, but Vindel Jones did. I don't know if he had much luck with it. Vindel Jones, well, he didn't because he's passed away and he looked for 30 years, but that was actually the next place he was going. There was a person, a professor actually out of Missouri, who was a dowser, and he contacted Jim Barfield. And so just to test it, Jim Barfield did, he had bars of silver because he tested his own, our worst fear, once Moshe Feiglin, the member of Knesset, had volunteered to do a scan on his own at Qumran, was to get a false positive. You know, a false positive is more dangerous than a false negative in that way. And so he buried bars of silver and tested the Lorenz metal detector that way. But he also did it once with, basically it was a dowser. And buried them in a park in Missouri, and it didn't work then. It didn't work in that case and in that context, and it didn't work for Vindel Jones either.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Is it Helena in New Jersey? Helena, good morning.
Yes. First of all, I want to thank you for taking my call. And, Michelle, I want to thank you very much for a most interesting presentation. I myself have a doctorate in biblical studies, and I studied the Dead Sea Scrolls for almost a year under Laron Schiffman. I don't know if you know of him.
Of course, he's a legend.
Yes, well, I must tell you, whenever I come to Israel, when I come two or three times a year, and I merely mention his name, they can't do enough for me at the museum. And I also want to thank you very much for mentioning two gentlemen that I know very well, namely Moshe Feiglin, and I do volunteer work for his party. But I think you should clarify that he wasn't arrested for just going up to the Temple Mount.
Right. Can you clarify that for us? Because I would love to hear it from you.
Well, first of all, they have certain prohibitions. And unfortunately, as much as I personally would like to go up to the Temple Mount, this is one of the reasons I don't go, because the restrictions. You have to walk along a certain path. You are constantly watched, especially if you're of the Jewish faith. Now, I know I go to Israel with groups that when they go up there, their passports are confiscated, and they're watched like hawks, and when they return, they're given their passports. Also, you're not allowed to enter to utter prayers. And obviously, Mr. Feiglin went off the path. And when I say off the path, obviously, he did attempt to pray up there. And one time, I believe it was 2 years ago, he actually went into the mosque. And I hate to say this, but he actually started a little demonstration within the mosque with various members of his party. And in fact, at the time, he was banned from ascending the Temple Mount at all. But being, as you said, he's in the Knesset, he managed to overturn the ban.
Helena, we just have a couple minutes before the break here. So did you have any comments on Qumran as a possible location for the copper
mentioned
treasure?
That it's an Area C. I don't think it is.
And why not?
I know I personally go with various groups to Qumran whenever I visit Israel.
And you probably blaze right by. There is technically a checkpoint, but you probably blaze right by it, right? I mean, this isn't an area that any sort of right-thinking person believes that Israel would ever give up, especially because of Qumran. But for the most part, it's uninhabited area. It's not important, but there is a kibbutz there. It's spiritually valuable, and it's valuable to Israel. And I don't think that Israel would ever give it up in negotiations. But
it
is not,
Area C.
West Bank.
It's definitely not Area C.
Why do you? Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Under the antiquities laws, they refer to it as it's under the ADCA, which is the archaeological department. So anything that's considered in Judea and Samaria is under their authority, and Qumran is under their authority. It's not under the Israel Antiquities Authority ever since 67.
All right, Helena, thank you for the call. Interesting perspective there from Helena. What is standing in the way now for them to at least start doing some careful probing or trenching in Qumran?
Right. So in 2012, Qumran was declared they used actually Jewish sort of biblical terminology for this, saying that the land would be experience a Shemitah. So it would every 7 years in the Bible that the land is supposed to rest. And so they actually declared that for Qumran, that the ruin itself would rest, that no excavations would be allowed at Qumran. And for the most part, there's been some excavations in the cemeteries around Qumran, but for the most part, they've held to that ever since then. So it was supposed to, I thought, at the time, everyone thought just last for a year, but it's actually lasted until now. And so,
well, the Shemitah should be over this year then.
Yes, but there's been no word of that. So,
all right. Well, we'll pick this up on the other side, Shelley, and we'll continue to take questions and comments as well. Here's Sloan taking us into the break with Money City Maniacs on Coast to Coast AM. And if you like what you're hearing tonight this morning, you might want to check out my weekly syndicated radio program, The Conspiracy Show. It airs live Sunday nights, 11 p.m. Eastern, and in delay on about 40 affiliates across North America. For more information and a list of affiliates, visit strangeplanet.ca. That's my website, strangeplanet.ca. And you can check out my podcast, Conspiracy Unlimited. New episodes drop every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. You can listen and subscribe by visiting conspiracyunlimitedpodcast.com. More of your questions and comments for Shelley Neese, the author of The Copper Scroll Project, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Coast to Coast AM, let's go right back to the phones. And Joe is in Monterey, California. Good morning, Joe.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Okay, this is an interesting subject. Maybe the stonewalling that people are getting searching for this is maybe you're searching not for gold, as you already found out, and that it's artifacts. And these artifacts can be very, very telling, very powerful. The Ark was an extremely powerful weapon, and it was in the front of the armies of Israel. they went into war and they just destroyed the enemy with the power that came from it. Well, what if
sure, it brought the walls of Jericho tumbling down. I remember that from Sunday school.
They ran, people ran in fear from this. What if they brought down a UFO with this and it's buried there and they had to make a map that people were sure to find, so they made it in copper, and they said, well, there's gold there, and that would get a lot of people digging. Other than that, I don't know if we really want to find the Ark, if it's that powerful, and if it has a questionable origin, because I don't think God needs an army, nor does God need to make weapons. Okay, I don't know. That's kind of big statement.
All right, okay. Shelley, your thoughts?
Sure. So there's something in the pseudepigrapha. So, you know, the texts that are outside of the Bible and not canonized, but do hold echoes of the Ark of the Covenant traditions. The Bible itself kind of goes silent after King Josiah in terms of the fate of the Ark. But some of these traditions, like the caller reminded me of the Apocalypse of Baruch, which is one of the pseudepigrapha, and it talks about something, you know, that perhaps, and I'm completely open to this, that man isn't allowed to be the one to find the Ark of the Covenant or any of the temple furniture, and that really it's going to be some sort of natural circumstance that is able to unearth these objects. And one thing that is really interesting is that Qumran is on a fault line. It's very prone to earthquakes, as is the Temple Mount. So most people believe point to some of these temple vessels being buried underneath the Temple Mount instead of Qumran, but either way, they're both on a fault line. And so the idea of some sort of natural consequence, that something in nature, and therefore God being able to unearth these things when it's time, is possible, and then some of these prophets indicate it. Baruch talks about, and actually Ezekiel does too, in terms of, you know, a river flowing from the temple and the Dead Sea having life again, and just in terms of more end times and more eschatological ideas of how these might come back into our lives and back into human history.
Well, is it possible that the fear here is that if they find, as you say, the temple furniture and the Ark and the vestments, that this might start the countdown clock on the end times, because that would clear the way for the construction of the third temple?
Right. And so that's always the leap of logic that comes pretty naturally next. There is another document called the Treatise of the Temple Vessels. It was the only copy we have of it was in a medieval manuscript in Amsterdam from a Jewish Kabbalist. But it seems like he's preserving a more oral tradition. And not that it's connected to aliens, but he does talk about angels and associating the with five priests and helping hide these items. So, you know, the Copper Scroll is sort of a dry commentary or a dry inventory, and the Treatise of the Temple Vessels is just this very rich and imaginative, but perhaps connected to some kind of oral tradition, that tells us that there was a covert rescue operation, that whether or not the Babylonians were knocking at the gate or the Romans were knocking at the gate, but prophecy was alive and it was well. And so these priests would have had some indication of what was happening, and the idea that they could secret out their most holy vessels and hide them for a coming day makes sense to me. I mean, it makes sense. It matches what we know from the prophets, and it matches what we know from the extra biblical sources. Second Maccabees tells an amazing story of the prophet Jeremiah secreting away temple vessels and hiding them on his way to Mount Nebo and sealing the cave and telling his followers not to even look, that it will be during the Age of Mercy when God brings Israel back that they'll be found. So it seems like there is some kind of promise there that's connected to the end times realm.
First time caller Levi is in Troutdale, Oregon. Levi, welcome to Coast AM. Good morning.
Good morning, Richard.
How are you?
I'm great. Richard, S-Y, because I love you, R-E-T-T.
That's it, my friend. You have a question or comment for Shelley Niece?
Sure. Shelley, ma nishma, ma shlomech?
Kol v'seder, toda.
I also learned at the University of Ben-Gurion.
Oh, amazing. It's the best place to go for full immersion, right?
It's beautiful. So when you were there, was there the fountain that that had the flowing water through the campus?
Actually, we used to always joke and say, when are they going to fix that crack, you know?
It was so when I was there, it was so beautiful.
What did you study?
I studied Lashon, language.
Great. Yeah, no, Ben-Gurion University is one of the unique experiences in terms of you can go to Hebrew University, which other people do. It's maybe the more well-known university in Israel, but Ben-Gurion University just seems to me like a more classical, traditional college experience. More people live there. It's not a commuter school. It was a great experience for me, as I'm sure it was for you.
Levi, do you have a comment on the Copper Scroll?
Sure. Well, not so much about the Copper Scroll, but 2 points, I guess. One was is regarding history. And Shelley, you mentioned that regarding the Ark of the Covenant, and Pompeii entered the Holy of Holies.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
Levi. Yes.
Right. So actually, Pompeii, he was a general of the Roman Republic. He died in 49 before the Common Era. It was actually Titus.
Oh, according to the... Okay, so it was...
It was Titus, not Pompeii.
Pompeii subdued Judea in 63 BCE. So that would have been possible for... It was him that barged into the Holy of Holies.
So my second comment that I would like to make was regarding the destruction of the temple. And from my understanding, the destruction of the temple and the Holy of Holies was because of Sinat Chinam, because of hatred.
Mm-hmm.
And are we talking about the second temple, Levi? Are we talking about the second temple in 70 AD?
That's right. 70 of the Common Era.
Yes.
Because of baseless hatred, it was destroyed. And I feel that the treasure is not about gold or silver. I feel the treasure is about love. And that's the treasure that has been buried, and we should rediscover it.
Right. Well, so much about Israel is just its story of rebirth is such a story of inspiration for all of us. The rebirth of Hebrew, the ingathering of exiles. I mean, Israel's modern story is one of inspiration for all of us.
Levi, thank you for the call. Let's say hi to Walt in Allentown, Pennsylvania. Walt, good morning.
Hi, Richard. I hope the mighty Aphrodite gave you a nice birthday present.
She gave me a wonderful dinner, Walt. We'll keep it at that.
Richard, with deference to Ms. Niece, she's undoubtedly aware that, you know, we have plenty of archaeological evidence that the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, and, of course, the Greeks and the Romans, they all had their epic tales and their religious myths. And I think the Dead Sea Scrolls, the scrolls really, they just verify the fact that the ancient Hebrews were no different. As I told Dr. Punnin a couple of weeks ago that, you know, in 1922, we unearthed King Tut. And, you know, they found numerous hieroglyphs and statuettes of Osiris and Horus. But that doesn't necessarily mean that those gods really exist now. Ms. Nee, I don't want to, you know, I'm not out to burst anybody's religious bubble. Ms. Nee is undoubtedly... you know, very religious, but she said that the Dead Sea Scrolls include Genesis, everything from Genesis to Deuteronomy. Well, in Genesis, it says that after Eve disobeyed Yahweh and ate the forbidden fruit, then Yahweh cursed womankind and said that only in pain shall you bear children. And Deuteronomy 22 says that if a woman doesn't bleed on a wedding night, that she can be stoned to death because she has used her father's house as a den of harlotry. So I just like to point out that to me, that those are obviously the words of a God who man has created, rather than vice versa. You know what I mean? It's all part of man's quest to understand where he came from. Back when the Bible was written, there were no telescopes, no microscopes, there was no real science. So this is how man rationalized his existence.
Well, we're not really here to discuss or debate, you know, the existence of God. I mean, obviously that is related to the topic, but we're talking about what amounts to an incredible treasure hunt here, and pretty difficult to deny the existence of the first and second temple, and you know, Solomon's riches. Shelley, did you want to comment further?
Well, sure. I was just going to add a note that the Dead Sea Scrolls, oddly, they have every book of the Hebrew Bible except for the book of Esther. And just one interesting theory is that the Dead Sea Scroll Library was actually a geniza. And a geniza is the Jewish tradition that if a document has the name of God on it, the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh name, that it's holy and cannot be thrown away or destroyed, and so they would store it. And we saw this happen when we found the Cairo Geniza, just centuries and centuries of documents that if it had the name of God was stored away. And so the Book of Esther is the only book in the Hebrew Bible that doesn't have the name of God in it, does not have the holy name in it, and it's the only book that we can't find in the Dead Sea Scroll corpus. So it's just an interesting note, whether or not, like the caller, whether or not you believe in God or the Hebrew Bible or not, it's an important part of our history.
Precisely. David is in Mason City, Ohio. David, welcome to Coast AM. Good morning.
Good morning.
Is David there? Hi, David. Go ahead.
Thanks for having me. I just wanted to call in and tell you story that my dad used to talk about a lot. One of the few things that his dad told him about. But my great grandpa, Lee Edwin Maxwinder, he worked at the church after he got out of the Air Force and became a pastor. You know, you talk about my dad, he would tell him about this project he did down in Florida. I think, I don't know if it was at a university or if he worked with some people at the university, but apparently they tried to recreate the Ark of the Covenant.
And did they have any success?
Well, they did, to the point where it was putting out so much energy. I don't know. I guess it was like electrical energy, but he said it was also putting off other energy. And, you know, I suspect that, you know, it might be a power source and it might generate scalar waves.
Well, there's been a suggestion that the Ark was essentially a giant capacitor.
Well, you know, for a scalar wave, you can kind of make anything just kind of disassemble down to the atoms, or, you know, you can make it levitate, or... So, you know, the way they destroyed the walls with it, and, you know, possibly maybe they use it to build the pyramids. And, you know, if they get those stones vibrating and at the right scalar wave, they pretty much one guy can lift it up and put it together, kind of like the Edward Casey, the Cole Castle thing.
Fascinating theory, David. Thank you for that. Shelley, did you want to comment further?
Well, just the Jewish tradition does hold that when the Israelites were wandering in the desert for 40 years, that, you know, we know that the Ark of the Covenant went ahead and was in front, and it says that the tradition holds that sparks would launch out from between the cherubim to to clear the way, and then it was capable of killing snakes and scorpions that were posing a threat. And like you said, Joshua in the Battle of Jericho. And so there are these incidents and traditions that just provide a little bit of an echo in terms of what the Ark's capabilities were.
Shelley, let's get back to the Copper Scroll. Where is it now?
So the Copper Scroll is in Amman, Jordan. It's separate from the rest of the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are in the Israel Museum in Jerusalem, because it was found by a dig sponsored by the Jordanian Department of Antiquities. They have held on to it. And so it's one of the scrolls that very few people have seen who have actually been to the Dead Sea Scroll exhibit in Jerusalem but have never had the opportunity to see the Copper Scroll.
It's never been on public display?
It is on public display in Amman, so it's a little bit out of, you know, most people's Holy Land tours. It's not part of the agenda.
And what is Jim Barfield up to these days? Is he still hoping one day to uncover the treasures?
Absolutely. So one thing that we've done is that after Knesset member Moshe Feiglin did the scan and we had a positive result, we did wait for years in order to be able to let this secret out and to let people know, because really we didn't want to implicate the archaeologists that we were involved in that could have hurt them career-wise. It wouldn't hurt Moshe Feiglin. It wouldn't hurt us. But it was important that we kind of let out the information all at once so that we are still allowed and Jim Barfield's still allowed back into the country. You know, he wasn't the one that conducted the scan. It was Moshe Feiglin, but also just hoping for a grassroots effort. At this point, we're asking to dig at one of the sites, the most promising site, right outside of Qumran, so it's not threatening to the ruins. There are archaeologists who are interested, and we'll just see if in the process they'll be stopped. But no, Jim Barfield's still going forward.
Well, Shelley, thank you for hanging out for 3 hours. I really enjoyed our conversation. And the Copper Scroll Project, an amazing story. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Shelley Neese. All right, that is it for me. And for George Norrie, George Knapp, Lisa Lyon, Stephanie Smith, Tom Danheiser, Dan Galati, Chris Burrows, Mike Cosio, Donna Walker, Greg Bishop, and here in Toronto, Mike Ben Dixon, Robert Turner, Patrick O'Neill, and in Brantford, Ontario, Scott Guitarflix. I'm Richard Serrett. Thank you for your ears and your voices, your beautiful voices. Until next time, so long for now.